Recorded Books presents a sci-fi audio production, The Fuller Memorandum, by Charles Stross. This unabridged recording is narrated by Gideon Emery. This book is copyrighted 2010 by Charles Stross. This recording is copyrighted 2011 by Recorded Books. Sci-fi audio is an imprint dedicated exclusively to science fiction and fantasy titles on CD. From classics to bestsellers, cult hits to critically acclaimed award winners. And now, The Fuller Memorandum.
Prologue. Losing My Religion. There can be only one true religion. Are you feeling lucky, believer? Like the majority of ordinary British citizens, I used to be a good old-fashioned atheist. Secure in my conviction that folks who believed in angels and demons, supernatural manifestations and demiurges, snake fondling and babbling in tongues, and the world being only a few thousand years old, were all superstitious idiots. It was a conviction encouraged by every crazy news item from the Middle East, every ludicrous White House prayer breakfast on the TV. But then I was recruited by the laundry and learned better. I wish I could go back to the comforting certainties of atheism. It's so much less unpleasant than the one true religion. The truth won't make your baby Jesus cry, because, sad to say, there ain't no such son of God. Moses may have taken two tablets before breakfast, but there was nobody home to listen to the prayers of the victims of the Shoah. The guardians of the Kaaba have got the world's best tourism racket running. The Dalai Lama isn't anybody's reincarnation. Zeus is out to lunch. And you really don't want me to start on the neo-pagans. However, there is a God out there, vast and ancient and infinitely powerful, and I know the name of this God. I know the path you have to walk down to be one with this God. I know his secret rituals and the correct form of prayer and his portents and signs. I have studied the ancient writings of his prophets and followers in person, not simply relying on the classified digests in the Codicil Black Skull files, and the background briefings for Case Nightmare Green. I'm a believer, and like I said, I wish I was still an atheist, believing I was born into a harsh, uncaring cosmos in which my existence was a random roll of the dice and I was destined to die and rot and then be gone forever, was infinitely more comforting than the truth. Because the truth is that my God is coming back. When he arrives, I'll be waiting for him with a shotgun, and I'm keeping the last shell for myself. A couple of years ago, Angleton suggested I start writing my memoirs. It seemed a pretty weird idea at the time. A 30-year-old occult intelligence officer should take time off on the job to work on his autobiography. But he had a point.
"Bob,"
he said in his usual frighteningly avuncular tones, with a voice like dry sheets of parchment rubbing,
"like it or not, that thick little skull of yours contains valuable institutional knowledge that has been acquired over years of service for HM government. If you don't start now, you may never catch up with the job. And if you don't catch up with the job, part of the laundry's institutional memory might vanish for good."
He gave a curious little chuckle, as if he regretted having had to admit that there was any value to my meager contribution.
"You might die on your next field assignment, or be turned by the enemy, and that'd be nearly 10 years of work down the drain."
Then he pointed me at the rulebook that explained how all officers above OC2 rank are required to either keep a classified journal or to periodically update their memoirs, which would be stored under lock and key, automatically classified under the various keywords they'd been cleared for during the time period covered, the books to be opened only in event of their author's death, retirement, or permanent disablement in the line of duty. You know something? I hate writing. I keep having to distract myself, hence all the little jokes. It's actually not as if the job is all that funny when you get down to it, especially as I have to write everything either in longhand or on a 1962 Triumph Adler 66 manual typewriter and burn the ribbons and carbon papers afterwards in the security office incinerator in front of two witnesses with high security clearances. I'm not allowed to use rubber bands or paper clips to hold the papers together, although string and, ye horrors, traditional red sealing wax, and don't get me started on how difficult it is to melt the stuff in a smoke-free building with fire detectors in every office, is permitted. My fingers are hardwired for the Emacs programmer's editor and a laptop. This historic office reenactment stuff gets old real fast. but I digress. This is the story of how I lost my atheism and why I wish I could regain it. This is the story of the people who lost their lives in an alien desert, bathed by the hideous radiance of a dead sun, and the love that was lost and the terror that wakes me up in a cold sweat about once a week, clawing at the sheets with cramping fingers and drool on my chin. It's why Mo and I aren't living together right now, why my right arm doesn't work properly, and I'm toiling late into the night trying to bury the smoking wreckage of my life beneath a heap of work. It's the story of what happened to the Fuller Memorandum and the beginning of the end of the world. Are you sure you want to carry on? Chapter 1. Going to see the elephant. Summer in England. Those words are supposed to conjure up halcyon sunny afternoons, the smell of new-mown hay, little old ladies on bicycles pedalling past the village green on their way to the church jumble sale, the vicar's tea party, the crunching sound of a fast-bowled cricket ball fracturing the batsman's skull, and so on. The reality is, of course, utterly different. It's an early summer afternoon in June, and I'm sharing an overcrowded train carriage with an assortment of tired commuters heading back to their dormitory suburbs, and a couple of angry wasps trying to drill their way out through the toughened glass. The hamster-powered air conditioning is wheezing on the edge of a nervous breakdown. It's 28 degrees and 90% relative humidity out there. And the asshole behind me is playing something very loud on a pair of tinny headphones. I'm having second thoughts about having paid £50 to sit on this train, expenses or no expenses, but I don't see what alternatives there are. I need to get from London to RAF Cosford, just outside Wolverhampton, and I don't have a car, and the laundry certainly isn't going to hire me a helicopter for a job that isn't time-critical. They won't even pay for me to take a taxi the whole way. So I'm stuck with a choice, train or coach. At least this way I get to avoid the M6 motorway. And at least I've got a seat with a table. I reread my instructions as the train shudders and lurches through the parched countryside. It's a low-priority field job, to investigate reports of eerie manifestations of a disturbing nature from one of the airframes stored in the hangar annex to the Royal Air Force Museum. The museum houses a lot of historic warbirds. Violent death tends to go with the territory, and a few ghosts. Echoes in the informational substrate of reality wouldn't be anything out of the ordinary. My job is to dispel any annoying manifestations, reassure the locals, close out the case, etc. It's sufficiently routine and predictable that I'd normally send the office junior, but for some reason, Angleton pulled me into his office this morning.
"Bob, I'd like you to deal with this one yourself," he said, handing me the brief. "It'll get you out of the office for a day."
"But I'm busy," I protested, a tad limply. The lack of aircon was getting to me, and I'm not good at standing up to Angleton at the best of times. "I've got to respond to the RFP on structured cabling requirements for the new sub-basement extension in D Block. Don't call it a crypt. The government doesn't do crypts. The Spanish Inquisition does crypts. And go over Claire's training budget. Can't Peter Fred do it? He's finished Exorcism 101. It's about time he had a field trip."
"Nonsense," Angleton said crisply. "You can take the paperwork with you, but I specifically want you to go and look at this one."
There's a warning gleam in his eyes. I've seen it before.
"Oh, no, you don't," I replied. "Not so fast."
I raised an eyebrow and waited for the explosion. Angleton is old school. So old school that I'm pretty sure I've seen his face in a departmental photo taken during the war, back when the laundry was an obscure department of SOE, the Special Operations Executive, tasked with occult intelligence gathering and counter-demonology. He doesn't look a day older today than he did back then, 65 years ago. Dress him in a bandage and he could star in a remake of The Mummy. Ice blue eyes with slightly yellowish scleras, skin like parchment left out for too long in a desert sandstorm, dry as bone, and twice as chilly as ice. And I never want to hear his laugh again. But I digress. The thing about Angleton is that despite, or in addition to, being the honorary departmental monster, he has a sense of humour. It bears about the same relationship to mirth that his cadaverous exterior does to Paris Hilton's, but it's there. He has the heart of a young boy, keeps it in a reliquary under the coffin he sleeps in. And right then, I figured he was winding me up for the punchline. But no, He shook his head slowly.
Not this time, Bob.
The gleam in his eye gutted out, replaced by dead-cold sobriety.
While you're up there to do the business, I want you to take a look at one of the other museum exhibits, one that's not on public display. I'll explain it later when you get back. Take your warrant card. When you're through with the job on the worksheet, tell Warrant Officer Hastings that I sent you to take a look at the white elephant in Hangar 12B.
Huh? I blinked a couple of times, then sneezed. You're setting me up for another working group, aren't you?
You know better than to ask that, boy,
he grated, and I jumped back. Angleton is nobody you want to stand too close to when he's even mildly irritated.
I'll give you the background when you're ready for it. Meanwhile, get moving.
Whatever. I sketched a sarcastic salute and marched off back to my office, lost in thought. It was a setup, obviously. Angleton was softening me up for something new. Probably a new game of bureaucratic pass the parcel, seeing if some poor schmuck, I was already in charge of departmental IT services for my sins, could be mugged into taking on responsibility for exercising hovercraft or something. Back to the here and now. The carriage is slowing. A minute later, I realize it's pulling into a mainline station, Wolverhampton, where I get to change trains. I shove my reading matter back into my messenger bag. It's a novel about a private magician for hire in Chicago. Your taxpayer pounds at work. And go to stand in the doorway. The air in the station hits me like a hot flannel, damp and clingy and smelling slightly of diesel fumes. I take a breath, step down onto the concrete, and try to minimize my movements as I go looking for the Cosford service. I find the platform it stops at, a crumbling concrete strip opposite a peeling wooden fence. The rails are rusty and overgrown, and a couple of young trees are trying to colonize the tracks. But the TV screen overhead is lit up and predicting a train will be along in 10 minutes. I take a shallow breath and sit down, hunching instinctively towards the nearest shade. 15 minutes later, the TV screen is still predicting a train will be along in 10 minutes. Then my mobile rings. It's Mo.
Bob!
She sounds so cheerful when she says my name. I don't know how she does it, but it cheers me up. Mo! Pause. Where are you?
I'm back in the office. I spent most of the morning in the stacks. I only just got your text.
The one telling her I was off on a day trip to Cosford. The laundry's deep archives are in a former underground tunnel, way down where the sun doesn't shine, and neither do the cellular networks.
Right. I'm on a railway platform waiting for an overdue train. It's about 200 degrees in the shade, the pigeons are falling out of the sky from heatstroke, and nobody will sell me a beer.
Well, they might if I'd asked for one, but...
Oh, good. When are you going to be back?
Sometime late this evening, I say doubtfully. I'm due to arrive in Cosford at... I check the lying timetable. 2:30, and I don't think I'll get away before 6. Then it'll take me about 3 hours...
Angleton did this. He did, didn't he?
Suddenly, Mo switches from warm and cuddly to spiky as a porcupine.
Didn't you tell him you couldn't? We're supposed to be having dinner with Pete and Sandy tonight.
I do a mental backflip, re-engage my short-term memory, and realize she's right. Dinner for 4, booked at a new Kurdish restaurant in Fulham. Pete was at university with Mo years ago, and is a priest or a witch doctor or something. Sandy is blonde and teaches comparative religion to secondary school kids. Mo insists we stay in touch with them. Having friends with ordinary jobs who don't know anything about the laundry provides a normative dose of sanity for the two of us, to keep us from drifting too far out of the mainstream.
Shit!
I'm more mortified for having landed Mo in it than anything else.
You're right. Listen, do you want to go out on your own? Tell them I'll turn up later. I'll come straight from the station. Or do you want to cancel?
There's silence for a second. Then she sighs.
Sandy doesn't have flexi time, Bob. She's got classes to teach. You cancel. But I don't have their mobile numbers.
I'm bluffing, and Mo knows it.
I'll text them to you, Bob. Maybe it'll help you remember next time.
Bollocks. She's right. It's my fault. Okay. It's my turn to sigh. I'll be claiming some hours back. Maybe we can use them for something together. The tracks begin to vibrate and squeal, and I look up.
It's my train. See you later. Bye.
The train to Cosford is about as old as Angleton. Slam doors, wooden partitions, and high-backed seats.
powered by a villainously rusted diesel engine slung under its single carriage. Air conditioning is provided by the open louvered windows. I swelter in its oven-like interior for about 40 minutes as it rattles and burbles through the countryside, spewing blue smoke and engine oil behind it. Along the way, I furtively leave my apologies on Pete and Sandy's voicemail. Finally, the train wheezes asthmatically to a halt beside a station overlooking a Royal Air Force base, with a cluster of hangars outside the gate, and some enormous airliners and transport aircraft gently gathering moss on the lawn outside. Breathing a sigh of relief, I walk up the path to the museum annex and head for the main exhibit hall. It's time to go to work. Pay attention now. This briefing will self-destruct in 15 minutes. My name is Bob, Bob Howard. At least that's the name I use in these memoirs. True names have power, even if it's only the power to attract the supernatural equivalent of a make-money-fast spammer. I'd rather not put myself in their sights, thank you very much. And I work for the Laundry. The Laundry is the British government's secret agency for dealing with magic, quote-unquote. The use of scare quotes is deliberate. As Sir Arthur C. Clarke said, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. So, magic is what we deal with. Note that this does not involve potions, pentacles, prayers, eldritch chanting, dressing up in robes and pointy hats, or most, but not all of the stuff associated with the term in the public mind. Nope, our magic is computational. The realm of pure mathematics is very real indeed, and the things that cast shadows on the walls of Plato's cave can sometimes be made to listen and pay attention if you point a loaded theorem at them. This is, however, a very dangerous process, because most of the shadow casters are unclear on the distinction between pay attention and free buffet lunch here. My job, applied computational demonologist, comes with a very generous pension scheme, because most of us don't survive to claim it. Magic being a branch of pure mathematics, and computers being machines that can be used to perform lots of mathematical tasks very fast, it follows that most real practicing magicians start out as computer science graduates. The Laundry, the government agency for handling this stuff, started out as a byblow of the Second World War codebreakers at Bletchley Park, the people who built the first working programmable computers, and the domestic side of our work, preventing accidental incursions by incomprehensible horrors from beyond space-time, has been growing rapidly in recent decades. You may have noticed there are more computers around these days, and more computer programmers. Guess what? That means more work for the Laundry. I have a somewhat embarrassing relationship with Wolverhampton. Back when I was at university in Birmingham, I nearly landscaped it by accident. I was trying to develop a new graphics algorithm. Planar, homogeneous matrix transformations into dimensions dominated by gibbering horrors tend to attract the Laundry's attention. They got to me just in time, just before the nameless horrors I was about to unintentionally summon into this world, and made me a job offer I wasn't allowed to refuse. Mo's history is similar. Indeed, I was involved not only in recruiting her, but in keeping her alive until she could be recruited. That was some years ago. Mo and I have been together for, about 6 years. We tied the knot nearly 3 years ago, using the urgent need to break a behavioural gesh as an excuse to do something we both wanted to do anyway. So, I'm here at RAF Cosford, an active Air Force base which is also home to the Royal Air Force Museum Annex, where they keep the stuff that's too big to fit in their North London site at Duxford. Ostensibly, I'm here to examine an aircraft that has been the locus of some disturbing incidents, and to stop those incidents recurring. Also, thanks to Angleton, I'm supposed to take a look at something in Hangar 6. One of the things you learn fairly fast in the Laundry is that most people in the British Civil Service and Armed Forces don't know you exist. You, your organisation, your job, the field you work in, are classified so deeply that the mere knowledge that such a classification level exists is itself a state secret. So, to help me do my job, I carry something that we laughably call a warrant card. It's a form of identification. It comes with certain powers attached. When you present your warrant card for inspection, in the course of official business, the recipients tend to believe you are who and what you say you are for the duration of that business. Not only that, you can bind them to silence. Of course, trying to use your card outside official business tends to attract the attention of the auditors. And having attracted their attention once or twice, I've never been too keen on finding out what happens next. The RAF Museum is fronted by a shiny new glass and steel aircraft hangar of an exhibit hall. I march right up to the front desk. There's no queue. Present my warrant card and say, "Bob Howard, I'm here to see Mr. Hastings." The woolly-headed volunteer behind the cash register puts down her knitting and peers up at me over the rim of her bifocals.
"Admission is £5, she chirps.
"I'm here to see Mr. Hastings." I force a smile and adjust my grip on the warrant card.
"Is that a season pass?"
She looks confused. "What?" I shove the card under her nose. "I have an appointment with Warrant Officer Hastings," I repeat, trying to keep a note of impatience out of my voice. "I'm from the Department of Administrative Affairs." It's a thin bluff. Jeans and T-shirt aren't normal office attire for the civil service, even in this weather. But I'm crossing the fingers of my free hand and trusting my card to untangle enough of her neurons to get the message across. "A meeting to discuss the, business in Hangar 6. She blinks rapidly.
"Oh, Hangar 6. That's a bad job. It hasn't been the same since Norman had his health and safety inspection. They used to keep the Whirlwind in there, did you know? You're wanting Jeffrey, aren't you?"
"Would that be Warrant Officer Hastings?" I ask, hopefully.
"Oh, yes."
She pushes her knitting aside with one liver-spotted hand and picks up the telephone with another.
"Jeffrey, Jeffrey, there's a man here to see you. Who did you say you were? Mr. Howarth. Yes, to see you now. He's out front."
She puts the phone down.
"Jeffrey will be here in a couple of minutes," she confides. "He needs to scrub up first."
I tap my toes and whistle tunelessly as I look around the entrance hall. There's something casting a weird shadow overhead. I look up and find myself staring at the bulging ventral fuel tank of an English Electric Lightning Interceptor, dangling from the ceiling like a demented model maker's pride and joy. It's enough to stop the foot tapping for a moment. If the cable fails, I'll be squashed like a bug. But a moment's consideration tells me that it's highly unlikely. So I stare wistfully at the lightning for a couple of minutes. Two missiles, sharply raked razor-thin wings, a huge pregnant belly full of fuel, and the two screamingly powerful engines that once rammed it from a cold start to 1,000 miles per hour in under a minute. Life would be so much simpler if our adversaries could be dealt with by supersonic death on the wing. But alas, human resources aren't so easily defeated.
"Mr. Hogarth?"
I turn round. There's a bluff-looking middle-aged man in blue overalls standing by the front desk. Sandy, receding hair, a gingery regulation moustache, and a face creased with questions. I hold up my warrant card. "Mr. Howard," I say. "Capital Laundry Services. I believe you asked for a visit." He does a visible double take.
Yes, I did."
He's clocking the jeans, T-shirt, and casual linen jacket, and I can see the gears whirring in his head as he wonders if I'm some kind of imposter. Then his eyes reach my warrant card, and something clicks behind them, and he's slightly less human than he was a moment before.
"Sir,
I was told your problem is in Hangar 6. Why don't you take me there? You can explain along the way." I put the warrant card back in my pocket. No point in frying him.
"If you'd follow me, please, sir."
He has a pronounced Borders accent. He turns and opens a door marked "Authorized Personnel Only."
"Sorry about Helen on the front desk," he murmurs. "She's a little slow, but she means well. Only see you. She's been helping out here since forever, and we run on volunteers."
He shrugs.
"I suppose it's better for her than sitting around an old age home waiting to die."
He lets the door close behind us before he says anything more.
"Bloody rum business, Hangar 6.
"Tell me about it, in your own words," I add.
"It's another of the lightnings, hull number XR727.
He glances over his shoulder.
"It's been sitting in Hangar 6 for years while we were waiting for funding to come through. Plan was to restore it for static display in Hull 4 when it's ready. It's an F Mark III, upgraded from F2A like the one over the front desk."
I'll take his word for it. I'm not au fait with the model numbers.
"We've had a few odd incidents."
Odd incidents? Define odd.
"Frosty patches on the hangar floor, mysterious oil leaks, under hydraulic pipes that were drained more than 20 years ago when it was taken out of service.
Nothing really unusual, seeing where it came from, if you follow my drift. But then there was the business with Marcia and the instrument panel, and I thought it might be a good idea to call you chappies directly.
Clunk. A domino slips into place in my mental map. This inquiry didn't come through the RAF. This came direct from Hastings. You've worked with us before.
Not exactly.
He pauses beside an anonymous door and extracts a fat keychain. But I was with a squadron on ground crew. Once you're in, you never really leave.
Click. They like to stay in touch.
What squadron, I wonder, annoyed but afraid to display my ignorance. Tell me about Marcia, I prompt, as he opens the door to reveal another prefab tunnel between buildings, this one windowless and stifling.
Volunteer airframe conservator Marcia Moran, age 29, completed her short service enlistment, then signed up with BAE Systems Maintenance Division when the defense review came down. She's solid. Was solid.
He took a deep breath.
She should never have been allowed to work on XR-727's cockpit instruments. We had them round the back, under padlock and warded by a Class 2 repulsion gesh. She shouldn't even have been able to see them. She'd have twigged straight off that it wasn't a normal F-3 integrated flight system and weapons control board. She wasn't qualified to work on it.
He falls silent as he trudges along the passage. What happened to her? I repeat. Hastings shook his head.
You'd have to ask the doctors. I'm not sure they know. They say she might be safe to release next month, but they said that last month too.
Another domino. XR-727 was one of the squadron's planes, yes?
They didn't brief you.
He doesn't sound surprised.
In here, Mr. Houghton.
I don't bother to correct him as he shoves open a side door and steps into an echoing, gloomy cavern of a room.
See for yourself.
The room we're in resembles an aircraft hangar, the way a mausoleum in a graveyard resembles a bedroom. It's dimly lit, daylight filtering through high windows, and the light reveals the mummified skeletons of half a dozen fast jets littering the oil-stained concrete floor. Their severed limbs are stacked in jigs and frames, their viscera embalmed in the canopic jars of parts bins, patiently awaiting resurrection, or at least reassembly into the semblance of life. There's junk everywhere. Toolboxes, rodent control traps, workbenches piled high with parts. Closest to the door hulks the fuselage of a Lightning. Its tail is missing, as are its outboard wing segments and the conical spike of its nose radar, but it's substantially intact. Close up, the size of the thing is apparent. A pit bull to the chihuahua of an old Russian MiG. Squat, brutal, built for raw speed. It's big, too. The wing root high enough overhead to walk under without stooping. Something about it makes me feel profoundly uneasy, as if a black cat has walked half the length of my grave, paused furtively, taken a crap, and been about its business before anyone noticed.
This is airframe XR-727. According to the official records, it was scrapped in 1983. Unofficially, it ended up here because of its history. It's a ringer. It was on the books with 23 Squadron and 11 Squadron, but they never saw it. It was working for you people, in the squadron.
I shiver. The hangar's weirdly, incongruously cold, given the bright summer afternoon outside.
It's logged 280 hours on the other side, escorting the White Elephants.
Angleton mentioned a white elephant, didn't he? I glance at the shadows under XR-727's belly. The concrete is stained and greasy with fluid, whirls and lines and disconnected nodes that swim before my eyes. Clunk. The final domino slides into place. Jesus, Angleton, I mutter, and pull out my PDA. Tap, click, boing, and I pull up the thermograph utility running on the rather non-standard card in its second expansion slot. I point it at the swirling directed graph that the phantom hydraulic leak has dribbled across the concrete apron, and the display flashes amber. I take a slow step back from the airframe and motion Hastings over. I don't want to alarm you, I murmur, but did you know your airframe is hot? Hastings shakes his head sadly.
Figures, he shrugs. Do you want to look at the cockpit instrumentation?
I nod. Just point me at it. Is it still where Marcia had her incident?
I haven't moved it. He gestures towards a canvas screen, surrounded by a circle of traffic cones with hazard tape strung between them.
Do you need any help?
I'm afraid I'm probably beyond help. I advance on the traffic cones, PDA held in front of me. It begins to bleep and warble immediately. Edging sideways, I look round the canvas screen. There's a workbench bearing a stack of black metal boxes, wires dangling, needles and dials glowing eerie blue. Blue? Glowing? I check my PDA and swear under my breath. If this was a radiation leak, I'd be backing away and reaching for the lead-lined underwear right now. But it's not. It's just thormic resonance, albeit at levels you don't usually see outside of a summoning grid. What the ignorant persist in calling a pentacle.
Scratch that. Do you have any conductive tape? A soldering iron? Some blue chalk? You're going to exorcise it, states Hastings. Right?
Right.
Got a field exorcism kit in the mess hut. Squadron issue, Rev 3, and I keep everything in date. Want me to fetch it?
I think that would be a very good idea, I say with feeling, thinking, field exorcism kit? Squadron issue? By the way, what was the squadron's unit number? Hastings stares at me.
666. Didn't they tell you anything?
Here is how you go about exorcising a haunted jet fighter, latterly operated by the more than somewhat secret 666 Squadron, RAF. You can explosively disassemble the airframe, if it's in the middle of a desert and there are no neighbours within a couple of miles. You can violate any number of HSE directives and outrage public opinion by dumping it at sea. Shallow waters only, we don't want to annoy the owners by violating the benthic treaties, and wait for time and electrolytes to wash the memories away. You can truck it to a special hazardous waste certified recycling site in Wales, where they have a very special degaussing coil for exactly this purpose. Or, if you believe in living dangerously, you can do it with a soldering iron, a stopwatch, a grounding strap, and a good pair of running shoes in case you screw up. Guess what Muggins here does? Look, it's a museum piece. They don't exactly grow on trees. Blowing it up and drowning it aren't on the menu. Shipping it to Wales would cost... well, it wouldn't fit on my discretionary expense worksheet. Too many zeros. More than two. That leaves the grounding strap and the running shoes. So if you were in my place, what would you do? I approach the anti-static point beside the nose wheel bay very cautiously, holding one end of a grounding strap at arm's length in front of me, the other fist clutching the stopwatch behind my back, legs tensed, ready to run. The grounding strap is basically a long conductive wire. The other end is attached to a villainous black signal generator Hastings pulled from the field exorcism kit. All bakelite and flickering needles on dials, like something out of a 1950s Hammer horror flick. There's a small but bizarre diorama occupying the middle of the hastily cleared workbench it sits on. A model airplane from the souvenir shop, a rabbit's foot, a keyring fob skull pendant, and a diagram carefully sketched in conductive ink. Look, this isn't quite as spontaneously suicidal as it sounds. I don't go anywhere these days without a defensive ward on a chain round my neck that'll short out a Class 3 offensive invocation. And Hastings is safely tucked away inside a grounded pentacle with Thoth Lieberman geometry. He's safe as houses. At least houses that aren't sitting on top of a fault line wound up to let rip with a Richter 6.0 earthquake. As it happens, I do this kind of thing regularly, every week or so. It's about as safe as a well-equipped fireman going into a smouldering inflammable store to spray cooling water across the overheating propane tank in the corner, next to the mains power distribution board. Piece of cake, really. As long as somebody's shut off the power. Are you centered? I call over my shoulder to Hastings. In the safety zone?
Yes.
He sounds bored.
How about you?
I'll be okay. I keep my eyes peeled as I shove the plug on the end of the strap into the anti-static point and twist. I've plonked my PDA down on the floor a couple of meters away and set it to audio, beeping like a Geiger counter in the Thorm field. It ticks every few seconds, like a cooling kettle. The airframe itself is probably safe, unlike the blue glowing instrument panel on the workbench, but it's a bigger physical hazard, which is why I'm tackling it first. I take a couple of steps back, then straighten up and walk over to the signal generator. Where was I? Ah, yes. I flip a couple of switches, and there's a loud chime, almost like a bell ringing, except slightly off-key. It sets my teeth on edge. Degaussing resonator on, I say aloud. Continuing the checklist from memory. Exclusion field engaged. I pick up my PDA, fire up the e-book reader, and shuffle round the airframe slowly, reading aloud as I go. Words in an alien tongue not suited for human lips. The signal generator chimes periodically. There's your exorcism in a nutshell. Bell, book, and candle. Although the candle is strictly optional if you're reading from a backlit screen, and the bell's a synthesized tone. Finally, after squeezing between the lightning and a tarp-shrouded jet engine on a trolley, I fetch up where I started from, back by the workbench. Last words. I pick up the microphone that's plugged into the signal generator, flip the switch, and say, "Piss off." There's a bang and a blue flash from the grounding point on the airframe, and my PDA makes an ominous crackling noise. Then the Thorm field dies. "You nailed it," says Hastings. "Looks that way," I agree, turning to face him. He looks past me. "What about the... Hey, what are you?" Now here's where things go wrong. Muggins here didn't bother to set up a ward around the workbench with a contaminated cockpit console before he sorted out the airframe, because he thought that he could do the two jobs separately. But they're not separate, are they? The law of contagion applies. The cockpit instruments had been physically bolted to the airframe for a number of years, and things that form a unitary identity for a long time tend to respond as one. More importantly, nobody had thought to tell Muggins precisely what Squadron 666 Royal Air Force did with its planes, escorting the white elephants. Muggins here still thought he was dealing with a simple spontaneous haunting. Bad memories, terrified pilot and near-death experience, that sort of thing, rather than secondary activation caused by overexposure to gibbering unearthly horrors, the necromantic equivalent of collecting fallout samples by flying through mushroom clouds. But I'm second-guessing the inquiry now, so I'll shut up. Warrant Officer Hastings survives the explosion because he is still inside his protective pentacle. Muggins here survives the explosion because he is wearing a heavy-duty defensive ward around his neck, and, in response to Hastings's call, has turned to look at the open doorway where little old Helen, with her tightly curled white hair, is standing, clutching a tea tray. Her mouth is open as if she's about to say something, and her eyebrows are raised. I will remember the expression on her face for a very long time. Beauty may be skin deep, but horror goes all the way down to the desiccated bone beneath, as the eerie purple flashbulb glow rises, and her eyes melt in their sockets, and her hair and clothes turn to dust, falling down and down as I begin to turn back towards the airframe and reach for the small pouch around my neck, which is scalding hot against my skin as the air heats up. There's a dissonant chime from the signal generator on the bench, unattended, then a continuous shrill ringing alarm as its safeties trip. The hideous light goes out with a bang like a balloon bursting, a balloon the size of the Hindenburg. "Shit," I hear someone say as I grab the ward and feel a sharp pain in my hand. I blink furiously as I yank, breaking the fine chain. There's a clicking in my ears, and I blink again, see white powder everywhere, like snow or heavy dust on the floor, a patina of corrosion on the aircraft wings stacked in their jigs around me, white on the workbenches. "Helen!" shouts Warrant Officer Hastings, stepping over the boundary of his protective perimeter. I don't need to look round to know it's too late for her, but I still cringe. I drop the ward and gasp as air touches the palm of my hand and the spot on my sternum that's beginning to sting like a kicked wasp's nest. My ears are ringing. I turn back to the bench with a signal generator to check my PDA for the Thorm field. Unwelcome surprises come in threes. Number one is, the bench is a centimeter deep in white, dusty powder. Surprise number two is, my PDA has gone to meet its maker. It's actually scorched and blackened, the case melted around one edge. And surprise number three, a thin, wispy trickle of smoke is rising from behind the scorched, naturally, canvas screens around the Lightning's cockpit instruments, ground zero for the pulse of necromantic energy that has just seared through the hangar like a boiling propane vapor explosion. Here's Hastings, kneeling and clutching a dented steel teapot that looks as if it's been sandblasted, sobbing over a pile of... The ringing in my ears is louder, and louder still, and the big hangar doors crack open to admit a ray of daylight to the crypt, and the howl of the airfield fire tender's siren, but they're too late. I get home late. Really late. So late, I end up expensing a taxi to take me into Birmingham to catch the last train, and another taxi home at the other end. Iris will probably give me a chewing out over it, but I'll cross that bridge when I come to it. The emergency response team kept me at the first aid post for a couple of hours, under observation, but I'm okay, really. Just scooped out and full of a numinous sense of dread, looping on the bright purple flash as I looked round and saw the door opening. Helen standing there for a moment as the Thorm field on the instrument console collapsed, sucking out the life from anything within a 50-meter radius that wasn't locked down and shielded. Hangar 6 isn't going to have a rat problem for a while. The unshielded instrument console entangled with the shielded airframe I just exercised, and the 70-something lady in the pink slippers, shuffling forward with a tea tray and two mugs she'd carefully poured for us, too clever by half. As I open the front door, I can feel the house sulking. I switch on the lights and hang up my coat in the hall, fighting the urge to hunch my shoulders defensively. It's Mo, of course. This is her house as much as it's mine. Okay, it's our maisonette. Two civil servants can't possibly afford a house in London, even if they're both management track, and it reflects her mood. I cancelled Pete and Sandy, but I can't cancel Mo. She's got a snit on, perfectly justifiable. I really ought to go upstairs and apologize, but as I bend down to untie my shoelaces, I find my hands are shaking. An indeterminate time later, I open my eyes. I'm sitting at the kitchen table with an empty glass in my hand. The quality of the light just changed. Bob? It's Mo, wearing a dressing gown, rubbing her eyes.
Shit.
Bob? Her tone of voice changes, softening slightly.
What's wrong?
I clear my throat, force air through my larynx. I screwed up. The bottle of Talisker sitting beside my left hand is half empty. Mo peers at it, then takes a step closer and peers at me. Then she picks up the bottle, pops the cork, and pours a generous two fingers into my glass, bless her. Drink up. She pauses with a hand on the back of the other kitchen chair. Am I going to need one too? Dunno. Maybe. She goes to the cupboard and takes out another glass before she sits down. I blink at her, red-eyed and confused. Talk. She pours a shot into her own glass.
In your own time.
I glance at the kitchen clock. It's 1 a.m.
And it'll be 1 a.m. again at least once a day for the rest of your life. So talk if you want, or drink up and come to bed.
I sip my whiskey. I screwed up.
How badly?
I killed a bystander.
A bite?
She freezes with her glass halfway to her lips.
Jesus, Bob.
Pause.
How did you do that?
She looks appalled, but probably much less appalled than your spouse would look if you confessed to killing someone over the kitchen table. Mo is made of stern stuff. Angleton sent me to do a routine job, only I missed something and fucked up my prep.
But you're still...
She bites her lip, and now she looks shaken. My ears sketch in the missing word. Alive. Oh, I almost got it right, I explain, waving my glass. Warrant Officer Hastings wasn't hurt, and I'm here. But then I remember the purple flash again, and the door opening, and the sight of Helen's face aging 100 years in a second right before my eyes. Only the tea lady opened the door at the worst possible moment. Mo is silent for a while, so I take another sip. Fatal accidents never happen because of just one mistake, I try to explain. It takes a whole chain of stupids lining up just so to put a full stop at the end of an epitaph.
So what did you do afterwards?
She asks quietly. Afterwards? It was too late to do anything, I shrug. I told them not to disturb the scene and called the plumbers. Then I had to wait until they arrived and hang around while they logged the scene and filed a preliminary report and bagged the body, which took all evening. They had to use a Dyson. There wasn't enough left of her to fill a teacup, never mind a reanimator's workbench. It's on the books as a level 4 excursion, incidental unintended fatality. The desk officer was very understanding, but I've got a 10 o'clock appointment with someone in operational oversight to file an R60. An official incident report. Then I suppose there'll be an inquiry. and the juggernaut of an internal investigation will start to roll, bearing down on my ass like hell's own lawnmower in search of an untrimmed blade of grass. But it's not as if I don't deserve it. I take another sip of the whiskey, wishing I could drown myself in it. This isn't the first time I've killed someone, but it's the first time I've killed a civilian bystander, and I lack the words to express how I feel.
"I was going to dump on you," Mo tells me, "but forget it."
She empties her glass, and I realize that while I was seeing that purple light, the whiskey has evaporated from my tumbler.
"Come to bed now."
I push myself to my feet, neck drooping. It won't make things better.
"No.
I feel like shit."
"No, Bob, you need to get some sleep."
"I am a shit."
"You need to get some sleep. Come to bed."
"If you say so." I follow her upstairs. Today's been shit, and tomorrow is quite possibly going to be worse. But it can wait for a while. Chapter 2. Pointing the Finger. I go to work in a nondescript office in central London, south of the river and east of the sun, I can't say precisely where, located above a row of shops. It's a temporary home for the department, and it's officially called the New Annex, probably because it was thrown up in 1964. It consists of three floors of characterless 60s concrete, piled up above a C&A, and a couple of other boring high street stores, like a bad perm on a grocer's granny. It used to belong to the post office, back in the day, and nothing you can see through the windows from outside is really there. The weather is just as unpleasant as yesterday, if not worse. Muggy and humid, warm enough to be annoying, but not hot enough to provoke businesses into paying for air conditioning. And there's a stale tang of vehicle exhausts and fermenting dog shit underlying every noisome breath I take. Wasps buzz around the overflowing litter bins on the street outside the office as I nip into the staff entrance to the store, then push through a plywood door labelled Building Maintenance Only and up a whitewashed stairwell with peeling linoleum treads. A lot of people go through that door every day, and they don't look much like store employees, but for some reason nobody seems to notice. Or more accurately, they can't notice. At the top of the stairs there's another door. This one's a bit more substantial. The wards make my skin crawl and send pins and needles singing up my arm as I push it open, but they recognize me as someone who belongs here, for which I am profoundly grateful. A couple of years back, a gang of thugs decided to ram raid us and steal the office computers. Boy, did they get an unpleasant surprise. I slouch over to reception. "Are there any messages for me today?" I ask Rita. Rita, who is about a year younger than my mother, and about as maternal as an Iron Maiden, stares at me in brassy-eyed surprise.
"Iris says she wants to see you if you showed up today," she declares. "Are you signed off sick or something?"
"No, but I might be contagious."
"Be off with you."
She turns back to her web browser, dismissing me, and I take a deep breath and head for Iris's office. Iris is my... how to describe our relationship accurately? Person from Porlock? Morlock? Latest line manager. I seem to get through about one a year. It wasn't always so, but Andy got moved sideways into research and development, and before him, Harriet and Bridget are... long-term indisposed. They took on Angleton and lost, epic level. I actually work directly for Angleton these days, but Angleton isn't a manager according to our org charts. He's a DSS, and DSSs are too important to burden with boring administrative duties like overseeing staff performance appraisals. So, although I work for him, I have to have an actual manager to report to, at least in theory, and that's where Iris comes into the frame. She handles my interface with human resources, payroll, and general admin stuff. She doesn't know everything I do, but she knows I work for Angleton, and it's her job to be my manager on paper. And she's good at it. Her office door is ajar as I turn the corner between the reception area and the coffee station. She's the kind of manager who's happy to sacrifice an outside office with a window in return for an interior one that lets her keep an eye on everyone entering and leaving her little fiefdom, which should tell you something. Her attitude is one of those irregular verbs peculiar to bureaucracies. If you like her, she's attentive, and if you don't, she's paranoid. "You wanted to see me, boss?" Iris waves me at the seat opposite her desk, She's leaning back with feet up and phone clamped between ear and shoulder, nodding along unconsciously to the beat of her unseen caller's narrative.
Yes, I understand. You can use his office, I think. When? Half an hour? Excellent, thanks. Yes, and you too. Bye.
She puts the receiver down, then hits the divert to voicemail button on her handset.
How are you feeling, Bob?
She looks concerned.
Like shit.
I don't see any need or room to dissemble. I came in because I've got a report to file.
Are you sure that's wise?
She raises a penciled-in eyebrow.
I've given you my presenteeism lecture, haven't I?
Bless her, she has. She's the first manager I've ever had who explained to me in words of one syllable that she'd be really pissed off if she caught me skulking around the office while I'm feeling ill. This is the laundry. They don't fire you for calling in sick. In fact, they can't fire you. All they can do is give you scut work. Back in my first year, I took 2 weeks off, once, just to try it on. I ended up going back to work when I got bored with counting the cracked tiles on the bathroom wall. We still maintain this endless pretense that we're the same as any other government department, clock-punching time misers all. But it's not true. We do things differently in the laundry. And so does Iris. And for a blessing, she admits it. I nod.
Good,
she says briskly, her accent so clear she could get a job as a BBC news anchor.
So,
she pauses.
Something went wrong yesterday, and you've got a report to file. Want to fill me in on it, so I know what to expect?
So I know what to expect is Iris speak form, so I can cover your ass.
Yeah, I fucked up a routine out-of-the-office job for Angleton.
I take a deep breath. One dead bystander in front of witnesses. Luckily, the only direct eyewitness is already sworn to Section 3. Section 3 of the Official Secrets Act, which covers our activities, is itself classified top secret under the terms of Section 2, making knowledge of it by unauthorized persons an offence, and we enforce it ferociously. I've got to file an R60, and then operational oversight are going to be calling the shots. There'll probably be an inquiry. I may be suspended pending the outcome.
Oddly, it's a lot easier to say this to Iris than it was to Mo.
Iris watches me for a few seconds.
Oh, you poor thing.
She nods to herself.
Was it bad?
It was stupid, I say between gritted teeth. Stupid, stupid. If I'd noticed the entanglement channel between the airframe and the control panel, or warded both artifacts at the same time, it wouldn't have happened. And if she'd opened the door 5 seconds sooner or later, it wouldn't... Shit. If I'd been told what the airframe had been used for, I wouldn't have... I trail off.
Save it for the auditors,
Iris says tiredly. She takes her booted feet off the desk, then leans forward.
That phone call I just took was your case officer, Bob. I think you should go and get yourself a nice cup of tea or coffee or whatever pleases you, then go and wait in your office. Business as usual is cancelled for the day. And if I catch you doing your timesheet or answering support queries, I will personally kick you around the block, okay? Go play games on Facebook or something. I'll bring your case officer around and sit in with you while you fill out the R60 so you've got a witness. If you think she's giving you grief, let me know and I'll handle it. Then,
she takes a deep breath,
I'm signing you off sick for 2 weeks. You don't have to take it. I mean, I can't force you. Hell, maybe you'd rather do some light admin and filing than sit at home or go for a week in York. That's my suggestion. But you're overdue for a slowdown, and I'm going to make sure you get it. But Angleton, leave him to me,
she says brightly, with a smile that shows me her teeth.
He'll do as I say.
Oh. Before I can open my mouth and insert any feet, she adds,
It's Angleton's job to point you at the enemy, Bob, but it's my job to keep you from breaking. I take my job seriously. If I tell Angleton to back off, he will.
Oh. I hadn't looked at it quite that way before. I managed to nod, then close my mouth.
Why?
I ask.
Fatal accidents never have just a single cause,
she tells me.
They happen at the end of a whole series of errors. What the inquiry is going to ask is, how far back did the chain start? And I'll tell you this right now, it started before Angleton shoved you out to go and do that job yesterday. But I'd better not say any more for now. Go and get that coffee. We've both got a tough morning ahead.
I'm sitting in my office, shivering over a cooling cup of coffee and reading the register, when my door opens without warning. I look up. It's Iris, which is no surprise, but the other visitor. Joe, I say, standing. Long time no see. Not long enough under the circumstances, she says with a twitch. Joe is short for Josephine, as in Detective Inspector Josephine Sullivan, formerly of Milton Keynes, but working for us in operational oversight these days. That's my fault. On the other hand, so is her still being alive after the Scorpion Stair business, so I suppose they cancel out. Looks a bit like Annie Lennox, if she'd taken up a second career as a nightclub bouncer. How are you keeping?
Badly.
I look round at the mounds of paper, the padlocked secure cabinet covered in Dilbert cartoons, the cubicle farm-sized novelty dartboard with a picture of the Prime Minister's face over the bullseye.
Ah, I wasn't expecting you.
Iris gives Joe a sidelong look.
You've met?
Yes. Joe gives her one right back. I won't let it influence me.
You're here to take my statement? I ask.
Yes. For a moment, Joe looks haggard.
Bob, what have you gotten yourself into?
I'll fetch another chair.
Iris catches my eye and shakes her head pointedly as she backs through the door. A mess. How long have you been working for Oscar Oscar? Joe sits down on the squeaky chair with no arms and opens her attaché case.
2 years now, she says quietly. Please tell me before we begin, while we're not under oath, you didn't do this deliberately.
I shake my head. Cross my heart and hope to die. It was an honest fuck-up.
Okay.
She takes a deep breath. I'm just here to fill out the forms with you and ask you the questions. If a decision is made to pursue an inquiry, I will declare a conflict of interest and withdraw. Are you happy with that? For a moment, I feel a flicker of gratitude amidst the gloom and dread.
Fair enough.
Iris returns, pushing another rickety office chair through the door. I approve. Most of my previous managers would have sent a minion to do that for them. Actually, mucking in and getting stuff done was beneath the dignity of their station. I'm still taking notes on Iris's style, although right now my career doesn't exactly look to be on course for promotion.
Are you ready to begin? Joe asks.
I nod. Joe pulls out a notepad and a voice recorder, then her official warrant card. She holds it up and my eyes are drawn to it, with a swelling, stabbing sensation in my forehead, as if a swarm of bees have taken up residence between my ears.
By the power vested in me in the name of the state, by the oath of service you have sworn under penalty of your mortal soul, I bind you to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
Not ask or order, but bind. My tongue feels swollen, as if I'm having an allergic reaction. I manage to nod.
State your name, rank, and date of birth.
I feel my lips move and hear a voice reciting. Iris is watching me closely, her expression hard to read. It's okay, I feel comfortably numb. I want to tell her, but my voice isn't having anything to do with my mind right now.
Yesterday morning, June 14th, you met with Detached Special Secretary Angleton in his office. Describe the meeting.
It's funny. I didn't realize I could remember that much detail. But the Gesh drags it out of me over the course of an hour and a half, and by the end of it, Joe is grimacing and wincing as her hand spiders back and forth across the pages of her report pad, filling it in verbatim. I'm not the only one whose muscles aren't under my own control while the report field is in force. Finally, she draws breath again.
Is there anything you'd like to add for the record?
She asks, turning over a new page. My mouth opens again, almost without me willing it.
Yes, I'm very sorry.
My jaw shuts with an audible click. She nods sympathetically.
Yes, I suppose you would be.
She closes the report pad with a twitch, says, "The report is now over," and switches off the voice recorder. Iris sags. I follow suit a moment later. Then Joe makes it a threesome. The wards on the cover of her R60 pad and voice recorder are glowing almost as brightly as the haunted instrument panel in Hangar 6.
What happens now?
I ask. My throat feels gravelly. Joe glances at Iris, who raises that eyebrow again, the one that can shut down committees or terrify demons to order.
I take this back to Oscar Oscar and have copies created under seal. One goes to Human Resources.
I try not to cringe.
One goes to the auditors, and one goes to internal affairs. Everyone else involved in the incident gets the same treatment. IA put the collected transcripts and the special coroner's report on the victim in front of the incident committee, who investigate and determine the cause of the event. I lick my lips. And then? Joe shrugs uncomfortably. If they find that the cause was negligence, they throw it back at HR for an administrative reprimand. If they attribute it to malice, they may action internal affairs to prosecute the case before the Black Assizes, but that requires evidence of actual criminal intent. Oh, and they copy health and safety on their findings, so H&S can issue guidelines to prevent a recurrence. Meanwhile, the auditors get a chance to muck in if anything catches their eldritch eye, but that's basically it. She delivers this with her best poker face. And in practice? Iris nudges. Do you really want to? Well, Joe looks at me sidelong. I'm not going to try to second-guess the incident committee, but it sounds to me like a straightforward mistake made by an overworked employee who hadn't been fully briefed and was in a hurry to get back to his other duties. If it turns out that the victim wasn't authorized to be in Hangar 6, the employee in question would be off the hook. Up to a point. But Jesus, Bob! Her composure cracks. I hang my head before her dismay. I'll not make that mistake next time, I mutter, then try to swallow my tongue. There won't be a next time, Joe says vehemently. What were you thinking, Bob? I don't know. Iris stands up. Thank you for your time, Miss Sullivan. She angles herself towards the door, transparently urging Joe out. I'm out of here, Joe says defensively as she stands up. I'll see you around, Bob, hopefully under happier circumstances. I nod as she leaves. Iris sits down again and looks at me, frowning. What are we going to do with you? She asks. I don't understand. To start with, you're taking the rest of the week off work, she says, and her expression tells me not to even think about arguing. And when you come back in next Monday, and not a day before, you're off active duty for the rest of the month. But Boris is short-handed and Angleton needs... They need you sane and fit for duty next month as well, she says sharply, and next year. You can pick up the cabling job you were specking out and the routine server upgrade, but you're not to go tearing around banishing demons and shooting up cows until further notice. A couple of months of boredom won't do you any harm, and more importantly, if it takes the stress off your shoulders so you're less likely to make mistakes, I'd call that a win, wouldn't you? I wince, but manage to nod. Good. She unwinds a fraction. You're probably wondering why I'm giving you the velvet glove treatment. Well, in case you hadn't noticed, you're now the focus of a fatal incident inquiry. You may or may not come out of it with your honor intact, but it is going to place you under stress. When people are under stress, they're more likely than usual to make mistakes, and I don't think you're any exception. So I'm not going to let you take on any hazardous jobs until this is sorted out. If you screw up and get yourself killed, then, speaking as your line manager, I will follow you all the way to hell and kick you around the brimstone pits. Because letting you make further screw-ups due to stress would not only be an avoidable, hence senseless waste, it would be a black mark on my record. There's a peculiar, dangerous gleam in her eyes. Are we singing from the same hymn book yet? I nod again, slightly less reluctantly. Good. Now piss off home and leave the damage control to me. She pulls up a strained smile, and I could cry. Go on, it's what I'm here for. Scram! I can take a hint. I scram. It is a truth universally acknowledged that a sane employee in possession of his wits must be in want of a good manager. Unfortunately, it's also true to say that good management is a bit like oxygen. It's invisible, and you don't notice its presence until it's gone, and then you're sorry. The laundry has a haphazard and inefficient approach to recruiting personnel. If you know too much, you're drafted. The quid pro quo is that we have to make do with whatever we get. Consequently, it should be no surprise to learn that our quality of management is famously random, governed only by the tiny shred of civil service protocol that sticks to the organization, and human resources' spasmodic attempts to cover up the most egregious outrages. As I already noted, I've had an unfortunate history with managers. I'm not a team player. I don't suffer fools gladly. And I don't like petty office politics. In a regular corporation, they'd probably fire me. But the laundry doesn't work like that. So I get handed from manager to manager as soon as they figure out what I am, like the booby prize in a game of Pass the Parcel. Iris showed up one morning and moved into the interior corner office that Boris had temporarily vacated. He was on assignment overseas doing something secretive for MI5, with her bike helmet and a framed photograph of her husband on his Harley, and a bookshelf consisting of The Mythical Man Month and a selection of mathematics texts. It was a whole week before she told me over coffee and a Danish that she was my new line manager, and was there anything she could do to make my job easier? After she put the smelling salts away and I managed to sit up, I confessed that, yes, there were one or two things that needed minor adjustment. And who knew? The trivial annoyances fucked right off shortly thereafter. Iris couldn't do anything about my biggest headaches. As Angleton's secretary, I get to carry his cans all the time. But she even managed to make him ease up a little in April, when I was overbooked for two simultaneous liaison committee meetings, one in London, one in Belgium, and he wanted me to go digging in the stacks for a file so vitally important that it had last been seen in the mid-1950s, slightly chewed on by mice. I don't know where in hell they found her, but as managers go, she's all I can ask for. I don't know much about her home life. Some laundry staff socialise after work, others just don't, and I guess she's one of the compartmentalised kind. But she seems like the type of manager who learned her people skills in the process of steering a big, unruly family around, rather than in business school. The iron whim is tempered with patience, and she's a better shoulder to cry on than any member of the clergy I've ever met. People who work for her actually want to make her happy. Which goes some way towards explaining, I hope, what happened later, and why, when Iris ordered me to scram, I hurried to obey. But not what I did on my way out of the office. Angleton's office is down a staircase and round a bend, in a windowless cul-de-sac that I'll swear occupies the fitting rooms at the back of the M&S opposite C&A. I've never been able to make the geometry of this building line up, but that's not surprising. When the rest of us upped sticks and moved to the new annex 2 years ago, to make way for redevelopment of the old service house site under some kind of public-private partnership deal, there was much headless chicken emulation, and many committee meetings, and probably several stress-induced heart attacks due to the complexity of the relocation. Angleton didn't show up to any of the planning meetings, ignored the memos and pre-uplift checklists and questionnaires, and cut the woman from logistics and relocation dead when she tried to shoulder barge his office. But when we got to the end of it, what do you know? His office was at the bottom of the rear stairwell in the new annex, just as if it had always been there, green enamelled metal door and all. I could easily go home without passing his door, but I don't. Now that the worst has come to pass, a gloomy curiosity has me in its grip. Why did he want me to go to Cosford? What was that guff about a white elephant? It'll bug me for the rest of the week if I don't ask the old coffin dodger, and Iris told me to go home and relax. So I curve past the crypt on my way to the lich gate, so to speak, and steel myself to beard the monster in his den. See, I'm calling him rude names. That's to prove to myself that I'm not scared of him like everybody else. See? I'm not terrified. The dark green metal door's shut when I come to it, but the red security light isn't on, so I knock. Boss? I ask softly. I hear a muffled noise, as of something very large and massive shuffling around in a confined space. Then there's a grunt and a heavy thud. I rest my palm lightly on the pitted brass door handle. Boss? I repeat. Heavy breathing.
Enter.
I push the door open with trepidation. Angleton's office feels like it's the size of a self-respecting broom closet, even though it's actually quite large. All four walls are shelved floor to ceiling in ledgers. Not books, but binders full of microfiche cards. In the middle of the room sits his legendary desk, an olive drab monolith that looks like it came out of a Second World War aircraft carrier. A monstrous hump like a 1950s TV set sits on top of it, like a microfiche reader. Except that it isn't. Microfiche readers don't come with organ pedals and hoppers to gulp down mountains of cards. Angleton's desk is a genuine Memex, the only one I've seen outside of the National Cryptologic Museum run by the NSA in Maryland. To those who don't need to know,
Angleton is just a dry old guy who rides herd on the filing cabinets in Arcana Analysis and does stuff for the Counterpossession Unit. His job title is Detached Special Secretary, which doesn't mean what you think it means. Scuttlebutt is that it's short for Deeply Scary Sorcerer. He's nearly bald, his chin is two sizes too small for his skull, and his domed scalp gleams like bone. With his wizened mannerisms, like a public schoolmaster from the 1930s, Mr. Chip's redux, people tend to underestimate him on first acquaintance. It's a mistake they only make once, whether or not they survive.
Ah, Robert.
He looks up from the Memex screen, his face stained pale blue by its illumination.
Please be seated.
I sit down. The chair, a relic of the Cold War, squeaks angrily. I fucked up.
Hold it for a minute, please.
He peers at something on the screen again, twisting a couple of dials and adjusting a vernier scale. Then he lifts a hinged lid covering the front of the Memex and begins to type rapidly on a stenographer's keyboard. Paper tape spools out and over into a slot behind the keyboard. He inspects it for a moment, then reaches over to a panel and pulls out two organ stops. There's a bright flash and a click, and he closes the lid over the keyboard with a look of satisfaction.
Saved.
The Memex is an electromechanical hypertext machine running on microfiche. It's fiddly, slow, lacks storage capacity, and needs a lot of maintenance. I once asked him why he stuck with it. He grunted something about Van Eck radiation and changed the subject.
Now, Robert, what did you think of the elephant?
Never got to see it. I shake my head.
Oh, dear.
Angleton looks mildly irritated. I shiver. That's what I came to tell you. I've just finished filing an R60, and Iris told me to sign off sick for the week. I killed a bystander by accident. It's a real fuck-up.
So you didn't see the white elephant?
I do a double take. Boss? Hello? Major Fatak incident while carrying out the primary assignment. What's so important about a museum piece?
Ugh.
He reaches out and flicks a switch. The Memex screen goes dark.
I thought it was high past time you were briefed on the squadron.
The squadron? That would be 666 Squadron RAF, right? I looked them up on the web. They were deactivated in 1964, weren't they? Angleton's thin smile tells me exactly what he thinks of the World Wide Web.
Not exactly. They were just redeployed in support of a higher mission.
I remember the blue glowing instrument panel lighting up the hangar from behind canvas screens and shudder.
What kind of... They're part of the contingency planning for Case Nightmare Green, boy.
He looks momentarily annoyed, as if the impending end of the world as we know it is a minor inconvenience.
Bystanders, he murmurs. Whatever will they think of next?
The white elephant, I prompt, but I'm too late.
Never mind that now, boy. You can go back and look at it later.
He looks at me, concern and irritation wrinkling his face further. And this time he's actually looking, studying me with those merciless washed-out eyes, as if I'm a sample on a dissection tray.
If Iris told you to take the rest of the week off, I suppose you ought to do as she says. A bystander, eh? What was a bystander doing there?
She was a volunteer at the museum. She was bringing us tea. Angleton's eyes narrow.
Was she indeed?
He picks up a pen and a pad and scrawls a list of numbers on it.
Well, when you feel like getting back to work, you might want to go down to the stacks and retrieve these documents from the dead file store. I think you'll find them very interesting.
He signs the note and slides it across the table at me. The document references are just catalogue numbers identifying files by their shelf location, no actual code words referring to named projects. Typical of Angleton to be so elliptical about things.
And I'd like you to deputize for me on the Bloody Baron Committee.
Iris is putting me on light administrative duties, I protest. Angleton smiles humorlessly.
Then you'll have something to do when you're bored, he says. Be off with you.
This ends Disc 1.